Thank you for standing by, and welcome to Santos 2020 full year results question and answer conference call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. The call will begin with Kevin Gallagher, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer, providing some opening remarks. We will then move straight to a Q&A with both Kevin Gallagher and Anthony Neilson, Chief Financial Officer. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Kevin Gallagher, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and welcome to the Santos results Q&A call. Joining me this morning is CFO Anthony Neilson. We're presenting our results a little differently this year. Anthony and I recorded a video presentation on today's results, which you can find on our website, along with the presentation pack, and I do recommend that you watch the video, as Anthony thinks it's riveting viewing. If anything is unclear in the video, we can upload a version with subtitles. It does cover what was a strong year for Santos, despite the challenges of the pandemic. We delivered record production and sales volumes, strong free cash flow of 740 million dollars, and underlying profit of 287 million dollars. We're not going to repeat the video presentation on this call. We will, however, be happy to take your questions. Before we do that, let me make a few brief opening remarks. As I said, we're pleased to release another strong set of financial results despite the external challenges of 2020. These results again demonstrate the resilience of our cash generative base business and strong operational performance across our diversified asset portfolio. The improvements in our base business in recent years were perfectly illustrated in 2020, with an average Brent oil price of $43 per barrel, generating more than three times the free cash flow as generated in 2016 at a similar average oil price. Our free cash flow breakeven was $24 per barrel in 2020, and we're targeting a similar level this year. At current oil prices today, the base business would deliver more than $1 billion free cash flow this year. The final dividend was $0.05 per share, in line with the previous final dividend. This brings full year dividends to $0.071 per share, representing 20% of free cash flow, and delivers on the board's commitment to review the full year payout at the annual results. I'm also delighted on the progress we're making on the Barossa project, and we're on track for FID in the first half of this year. All consents are in place for our 25% sell downs in Bayu-Undan and Darwin LNG to SK. The deal is binding and subject only to FID on the Barossa project. We're also finalizing the  12.5% sell down in Barossa to JERA, and as was said on the results video, we've completed all the agreements with Darwin LNG for the processing of Barossa gas. The Moomba CCS project is FID ready and only subject to the government finalizing the eligibility criteria for carbon credits. We've set out a clear and credible roadmap to net zero emissions by 2040. We have been and remain unrelenting in sticking to our strategy and implementing our disciplined low-cost operating model. An operating model that has proven its value by delivering consistent results, keeping the business resilient and performing strongly despite the challenges of the past year. We continue to generate strong free cash flows, maintain the strength of our balance sheet, provide dividends to shareholders, and we are now very well positioned to fund our growth as demand recovers and oil prices improve, and to position Santos as a leading company globally managing the energy transition. With that brief opening, we'd now be happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star two. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from James Byrne from Citi. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for the brief presentation. Look forward to watching the video. So I just wanted to have a bit of a conversation first around what's happening in Papua New Guinea. Now, last week we saw Papua LNG have the fiscal stability agreement, and you know, appreciate that you don't have equity in Papua LNG, but you've obviously got commercial agreements between Papua LNG and PNG LNG for the common use of that site. Just wanted to understand what the current status is of those commercial arrangements. And then, you know, from your perspective as an owner of PNG LNG, how do those commercial arrangements sort of tie in with timing of Pinyang fiscal terms? Or is it kind of, does that not matter anymore because, you know, the time for Train 3 to be sanctioned has passed us?
Well, look, thank you for that, James. It's a good question. Look, the there's a lot of questions within that one question around PNG. I guess what I would say is I'll agree and confirm that we're not in Papua LNG, so that's correct, and consequently, I'm not going to comment on anything around that particular agreement. In terms of what that means for PNG LNG joint venture, those discussions haven't really commenced yet, and you know, we're not in a position to give any sort of clarity on the way forward for PNG LNG at this point in time, and we'll look forward to those conversations with Exxon and the joint venture partners in the coming weeks or months. In terms of Pinyang, look, we signed an LOI. As you know, we've never executed that agreement yet. It's still live, but the reality was that agreement was set in a very different time period with different long-term price forecasts and things like that. And so ultimately, we'll have to sit down with the joint venture partners to review the merits of that and the conditions around that. And the other thing that's changed, of course, is when we did do that agreement, we were looking at Pinyang then as being Train 3, and in reality, it's probably moving more now as a backfill project than an expansion project. So look, I think there's a lot of discussions still to be had in all of that, and ultimately for Santos, with a strategic vote to agree to the Papua LNG expansion, we need to always be mindful of the risk and benefit balance on any agreements before we'd say we've got a pathway to expansion.
Got it. But wasn't there the agreements between the two joint ventures already termed and priced? So are those
There's no formal agreement. So I mean, basically, they were all part of the sort of LOI intent to lead to those agreements, and those agreements haven't been finalised.
Got it. Okay, thanks for clarifying that. Then just looking at the OPEX guidance for next year, you've effectively got the midpoint of your OPEX guidance slightly above what you'd achieved in calendar 20. And, you know, I look at your production and it's slightly lower at the midpoint to what you achieved. So that kind of makes sense. But as I read the comments that you had made, Kevin, in the release, that you're looking at further efficiency gains, improvement initiatives in the midstream. How do I think about the cost base of the business going forward when, you know, those efficiency gains aren't really reflected in the guidance?
Well, look, I mean, you're right to point out that we'll continue driving efficiency gains, and you've seen that we delivered quite a lot of those even in the last 12 months. Now, all of that didn't come through in the unit cost because we also are fighting the upward pressure of FX movement during that time. And I always remind people to the fact that our revenues in US dollars predominantly, but our costs are predominantly Australian dollars. And so they tend to offset each other a bit. And that'll be the same. We would see that as being the same in 2021, hence the guidance, the range that we've given you. So really it's about continuing to drive efficiencies across the operations. We've given you some guidance on what we see that being over the next few years through that midstream part of our business, and we'll continue to drive efficiencies in our upstream drilling as well, the onshore drilling, etc. But maybe I'll just ask Anthony to add to that.
And James, also in that range, we've got Bayu-Undan, obviously at 68%, and it depends on your assumption around the sell-down timing to SK for that 25%. So that's another reason why we've got a broad range in there, and you know, the assumption on the sell down we're saying is in the first half, but obviously later in that first half. So the first half will be assuming the sell down occurs, the first half will be obviously a higher OPEX than the second half, and that flows through to the average for the year as that range.
Got it. Great. And then the last one from me, just around the midstream infrastructure value and optionality described on slide 31. Appreciate that disclosure. I'm interested in understanding a little bit about the capacity contracts that have been written. Can you help us understand like the benefit of that, firstly, to how it affects your P&L, such as, you know, if volumes from third parties start to decline, that you've still got a sticky revenue base, but then also how it might help you unlock some of that latent value that you see?
Well, look, I mean, I think you've sort of answered that for yourself, James, frankly, but, you know, across that midstream portfolio, we've set that part of the business up now to drive more of those term and capacity contracts, just as any midstream operator would want to do. And that helps you plan your OPEX, your maintenance plans for years to come when you've got that certainty of revenue stream. Now, we don't have that in every asset. But that's exactly how we've just set up Barossa with Darwin LNG. So that is a term contract for the term of the Barossa project with capacity commitments, and you would have the usual take or pay on both sides of those types of contracts, the usual take or pay conditions. We'd like to see more of that across the other midstream assets. They don't all have that, but ultimately, if you have that, then if you ever decided to want to realise some value by selling down some of that ownership, then that would help you crystallise that value.
Over what sort of time frame are we talking about in terms of getting take or pay over assets like Port Bonython?
Oh, look, I mean, I wouldn't want to put a timeline on that, James. It really depends. You know, essentially, those negotiations with third-party providers will have to play out, and how they play out, I wouldn't want to forecast. In some cases, the provider may not want to agree to that, and hence that would be a different tolling regime. If you know, it's all about risk reward at the end of the day.
Indeed. All right. Thanks. That's all from me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Daniel Butcher from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hey, Dan. I think you must be on mute.
Please try calling back. Your next question comes from Mark Samter from MST. Please go ahead.
Morning, Mark.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing? A couple of questions, if I can. I mean, the first one, again, back on the infrastructure. Do you have a feel for when you're going to be time-wise in a position to think about crystallising the value in some bits of this infrastructure? I mean, do we think that could be a later 2021 story, or is it a bit longer beyond that?
I would think it'd be towards the end of this year that we'd be in a position where we'd have the structures established that would allow us to consider that option, Mark. So that's probably as much as I'd want to stay on that without trying to go down any rabbit hole on it. But ultimately, it's about setting up those structures, ownership structures, for that collection of assets that gives you the ability to do that. And, you know, Anthony, I mean, don't think there's anything you want to add to that, but timing-wise, we'd see that taking the bulk of this year, getting all in place.
As we said, Mark, yesterday, this year's about establishing the business and really getting those arrangements in place so that and good line of sight and see through to an earnings stream.
Cool. And then second question, if I can, just on Barossa and just thinking about FID timelines and the cost side there. One of your very illustrious peers just said a few minutes ago that there's, if anything, downward pressure on the cost side in LNG projects, and time is their friend there, and if anything, costs are going to come under initial expectations. Are you seeing the same thing, that you can just kick back and relax and costs just keep coming down at these projects?
I'm not biting on that one, but what I would say on that, Mark, is we've given guidance. A lot of our costs are locked in. Ours is an offshore, predominantly offshore project. So a lot of the contract packages are locked in, and the costs are locked in. We're pretty happy with those costs. What we would see in terms of foreign shipyard costs and stuff like that is that if we were to delay FID on our project with the scopes that we are talking about, we would see more upward cost pressure than downward cost pressure. And my fear would be that as governments put in stimulus packages going forward, that's more likely to drive inflation than not. And we've seen when everybody starts driving the or trying to develop the projects in the past, typically you see wages and costs going only in one direction. So we're pretty pleased with where we're at, with all of our terms on our major contracts agreed. And in terms of the timing, that's about really closing out the final documentation on really one or two big contracts. The biggest contract, of course, being the FPSO. That's the largest component. And as you know, we structured the contract, the hybrid structure of that contract, to help us deal with this particular issue and get that low cost of supply down to the lower end of the market to around $2 per MMBTU when we're in production. And so we're pretty confident on our costs. We've locked all of those in. And as long as we take FID in the time frame that we've indicated both in this update and the guidance we gave previously, we'd be very confident in that cost structure.
Perfect. Thanks. And I might just chuck in one last question if I can. It's a bit of a kind of bigger picture one. You know, obviously, the macro world around us is improving, but perversely at a time when there's probably more and more pressure on asset owners for some hydrocarbon assets. Without blowing smoke up your guys' posteriors too much, you guys have done a lot of great work on the M&As that you've done the last couple of years, and obviously, yeah, you're a company that the market backs to do good and sensible deals. When we think about the future of Santos, do you see the scope to capitalise on maybe others' misfortunes as we go through the next few years?
Well, look, I mean, what we've said about the previous M&A deals that we did, Mark, was that they were opportunistic, but they were on strategy, and we're very focused about building the strength around our core assets. And what that does is it limits the risk. I mean, things can go wrong, of course, but it limits the risk. You know, we're buying producing assets that we know, and really just strengthening your position. And that allows us also to then look at how we can create value through synergies. In both the Quadrant acquisition and the Conoco acquisition, we've delivered very significant value through synergies. And I think we say here we're on track to meet that latest guidance of between 90 and $105 million US dollars guidance we gave in December. And let me tell you, you know, I'm pushing to be at the top end of that guidance, not the lower end of that guidance, so and I'm confident we can achieve that. So look, I think that's our approach is around our five core asset hub. We're not out there looking for wild, opportunistic, off-strategy acquisitions. Any acquisitions we do in the future will have to keep us on strategy and be consistent with the five core asset strategy and the sort of clean fuel strategy we've rolled out to you guys previously. But what I would also say is, the first part of your question there, is our focus is on cost of supply because we can't control price. And so as a company, we run our business on cost of supply metrics in each market that we operate in and want to be at the lower end of the cost of supply curve. And what that does, as you saw in 2020, is it does allow us then to be able to navigate the tougher times and still generate free cash flows and pay dividends, but hopefully allows us to really take advantage of the upswing in commodity prices. And you know, you started off talking about macro conditions. It is my belief that demand will continue to grow. We saw, even in 2020, we saw some LNG demand growth. And so it is my belief we'll see continued growth for gas and LNG particularly, and for oil. It'll drive oil prices up in the longer term. And I only see supply lagging. And I don't believe all the LNG projects that were suspended will come back. And as you can see worldwide, it's taking longer and longer to approve oil and gas projects. Hence, I think the supply side's what's going to struggle to keep up. And that normally means we can see higher prices in the longer term.
Perfect. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Adam Martin from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Probably a question for Anthony. Just hedging. I'm just wondering if now's the time to get a little bit more aggressive hedging some of those 22, 23 volumes, particularly, you know, gearing's pretty high. You're about to embark on some bigger projects, hopefully, next 18 months. So just wondering there whether you pursue a sort of more aggressive hedging strategy.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Yeah, look, from a 21 perspective, as you've sort of, we've already said, and you can see we're pretty full. We've still got maybe a little bit of capacity if we wanted to a bit more in 21, but we like our position. We've got 15 million barrels this year hedged. And when you combine that with our domestic gas contracts, which is about 40% of the portfolio, that means we've got well over half of our current year production hedged and mitigated to the downside in oil. And so then we do want to start to flow that into 2022 and 2023, particularly as we approach the growth and FID decisions. We've actually started hedging 22 this week with the pop in the market. So you can see in the investor pack on page 45, we've actually done 2 million barrels of hedges this week with a zero cost collar and a $50 floor. So we are convincing the 22 and beyond program. So yes, we will look at that.
Okay, no good. Just now, Cooper Basin oil production, we've seen that sort of down in 20 versus 19. Really, we've seen issues at Beach recently, Western Flanks off with bars, et cetera. But how are you thinking about sort of chasing oil production next 1-2 years, please?
All right. Well, look, Adam, we're really looking at maintaining sort of current levels of oil production in the Cooper over the next few years. Our focus has been very much on gas development and horizontal drilling in gas fields and gas wells. And as a consequence of that, that's why you've not seen us really chase growth in the oil. And you know, in 2020, of course, that was very much around economics. Oil prices as well drove that. You know, if we see a pop in oil price, who knows, we might direct the rigs to drill some more of the oil wells. But at this point in time, very strong focus on gas. And continuing to put more of those horizontal wells in the Cooper, which you can see are delivering higher sort of returns in terms of ultimate recovery per well and production rates per well for lower unit costs.
Okay, that makes sense. Just final quick question. You look like you're very close to FID. Also, what are the sort of things or the remaining things you need to get done in the next few months to make that happen?
Well, really, the big one, now that we've sort of met all the conditions on the SK sell down, and I'll just reiterate, that now is finalised or crystallised on FID of Barossa. All approvals and all conditions are satisfied. And that's for the sale of 25% equity in Bayou London and Darwin LNG. We've got all the processing agreements in place, and really the big deliverable for us now is just the finalisation of the FPSO contract, which we informed you in December we had agreed all the terms on that, and so we're just finalising the contract, and we would expect that to be a matter of weeks rather than months, and then we're essentially there to take FID. We are progressing the SPA with JERA in parallel, and that's got some requirements from those contracts that need to be completed before we can complete that deal, but we're progressing that in parallel, and that's for the sale of 12.5% of Barossa equity to JERA. So look, we're in the home straight. We've tied up the offtake agreement for our share, our equity LNG. We've tied up the sell down to SK. All the other contract packages are in place other than the FPSO contract, which, as I say, will be there in a few weeks' time. And so we've ticked all those boxes, and, yeah, as you're right, it's getting close. We'd expect it to be in the next few months.
Okay, great. Thanks. That's all for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Gordon Ramsay from RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin, for the presentation. Reserves, your reserves update, you had a pretty large downgrade for Reindeer. That 27 million barrels, what percentage of that was of the total book reserves that you had for Reindeer? Just trying to get a feel for materiality.
So you broke up there, Gordon. Can you just repeat that question, please?
Sorry, just the downgrade in reserves for Reindeer of 27 million barrels of oil equivalent. What percentage of that it represents the total reserves of the field?
Of the
field, yeah. Book. Yeah.
We don't give the specifics by field. The best way to think of, I suppose, the WA gas business is it's one CGU. So from that regard, you've got all of the different fields flowing into both Devil Creek and Reindeer, and you can swing them between and accelerate between that gas hub, if that's a better way of looking at it, Gordon. So when we look at the total reserves and total production profile, and when it flows through into the ultimate impairment, it's looked at as one gas CGU is a better way of looking at it.
Okay, so, Anthony,
a lot of the gas, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay, so if we look at the Devil Creek gas plant, how much gas going into that came from Reindeer?
No, all of Reindeer gas goes into Devil Creek.
Yeah, so you're looking at now Corvus. Is it going to be fast-tracked because of the sudden watering out of part of the field?
Yeah, well, what we have said, look, we've still got quite a few years left with Reindeer going through Devil Creek. But you're right, there's a number of prospects there. I think all over, you know, between offshore Varanus and Devil Creek, I think we've got about 1,200 PJs of 2C, of known 2C opportunities to develop around there. What we're planning to do with respect to Reindeer is drill the Dancer well this year to give us some more capacity around the Devil Creek facility, and so that'll be the first prospect we're going to drill there, and we'll do that as part of that drilling campaign when we're drilling in that region later this year, when we're drilling the Apis and Parvu wells, and as part of that drilling campaign, Dance, and of course, as you know, we're doing Spartan around the Varanus Island facilities as additional backfill there. So we've got an awful lot of contingent resource. And what this really does is it's really said to us we want to drill some of that up a bit faster and start building the inventory back up again. And we'll start that process with this year's drilling campaign.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Saul Kavanagh from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hey, Saul.
Thanks. Hi there. Thanks. Gents, I have a few questions focusing around the reserves report earlier in the week. My first one's just back on PNG. The downgrade of Juha, about 9% of PNG LNG reserves. Could you explain what's driven that and if the reserves redetermination issue in any way factored into it?
Let me answer the second part of that. The answer is no. Redetermination didn't factor into that whatsoever at all. Look, we've just got a very strict reserves accreditation process in Santos, something we put in four years ago or so, and every year we will audit more than 90% of our reserves across our portfolio, across all of our assets. Every asset gets third-party reserve certification each year, and as a consequence of that, one of the rules that we follow is if we don't have a development path, a degree of certainty or a line of sight to a development path for that reserve, then we keep it as 2C. And really, it was simply a case of following our own internal rules that with the lack of a developed development scenario for those reserves, we've just moved the 2P to 2C. Basically just accounting and sticking to our reserve rules.
Understood. So I guess my question then is, when I look at the other backfill options you put out there, which all seem either subject to exploration or fiscal terms uncertainty still, do you have any concerns then about decline and the implications for the long-term contracts in PNG LNG?
No, absolutely not. We've got very solid reserves to contracts coverage ratio on that project. And in terms of these reserves, I think what's really important to point out is they've not gone away. I mean, we've just classified them as 2C rather than 2P because we don't have an agreed development plan in place for those at this point in time. And, you know, we try to establish that protocol and that standard, if you like, across all of our assets so that we can have confidence in our reserve position when we put those reports out. And that's why we've gone back to that practice of releasing that report ahead of our results. We think it's a good practice to establish.
Great. I guess my last one on this then is the base business production profile that I think Santos released late last year in the investor briefing day. Does that only include the 2P in PNG LNG with the current decline? It's like, does that include Juha in it, or is there downside risk to that base production now that you've taken Juha out?
No, because we did not have a development pathway agreed for the Juha reserves, they were not in that base business production profile.
Got it, thanks. And I don't want to sound repetitive, but if we're just like looking again at the Reindeer downgrade, again, that base production profile, does that include the Reindeer downgrade, or is there risk of steeper decline towards the late end of that now that the Reindeer reserves have come off?
The Reindeer reserves doesn't affect any of the contracted coverages. And if anything, as I said with Gordon's question, we can still accelerate gas through VI and deliver the production profiles that we need to do. And then Kevin, as he mentioned, has got the backfill opportunities that then come in and can hopefully pick up the back end of the curve, but that's in several years to come.
Yeah, our current 2P reserves to contract coverage in WA, Saul, is 1.8 times.
Yeah, great, thanks. One last one on WA. When you mentioned that you treated as one business, essentially integrated unit, the gas business, so does that imply that, you know, Dorado aside, where obviously there's been plenty of value accretion, but for the WA gas business, based on the value you allocated for it at the time of acquisition, from Quadrant, that is now actually, in your view, worth less as the base business in the wake of the impairment? And what discount rate are you using to do the impairment assumption for the WA gas business?
Yeah. So the impairment of $98 million is off the WA gas business, but it's off the goodwill that was associated with that. But effectively, the best way of thinking of it, the goodwill was associated with WA gas. So yes, the WA gas business is less $98 million more than what we thought it was. That's what an impairment does. In the sense of discount rate, we don't really disclose them. They're different by asset and they're quite sensitive. It obviously varies depending on sort of your contract coverage and contract structures and stuff as well on the sensitivity of it. But suffice to say, the discount rate hasn't moved significantly. It's been ups and downs over sort of the past 2 years. I think the most important bit to sort of note, though, with that whole WA gas business and Quadrant acquisition is that, as Kevin said, we've delivered a hell of a lot of synergies, $90 million, ballpark, that have flown through. And I think that the value of the whole acquisition, when you look at it, not just as a WA gas business, but the accretion from the Dorado transaction and costs in SG&A and OPEX and exploration and other parts of the business that have flown through. So you've kind of got to look at it in totality to really get the sense of the total value accretion that's occurred as part of Quadrant, not just the WA gas business on its own. There's a large accretion that's occurred across the whole portfolio of that Quadrant acquisition.
Understood, thanks. My last question is just a follow-up, Kevin, on your comments regarding M&A before, where I think you mentioned you're looking potentially, you know, when you look at it, to do it around the five current asset hubs, but you also mentioned the clean fuel strategy. Can you provide more colour there? Is Santos considering M&A around clean fuels, and any more colour or context you could provide around that?
Look, I mean, I think what I'd say in that, Saul, is that we would never comment great choice of words, isn't it? Fuel speculation and on M&A activity. All I was saying is that it would have to be along those lines to be consistent with strategy if we did anything. You know, we're not actively pursuing any M&A at this point in time. We've got a lot of organic activity on the go. We said that we'd progress that in a disciplined manner. We've been doing that now, for even through 2020, where we're able to progress, you know, get the Barossa project back up after deferring it, and progress that to being almost FID ready now. And that's very much a short to medium term focus. I was really just answering the context of the previous question, which is if an M&A opportunity was to present itself, it would only be of interest if it was on strategy. We're not going to deviate from our trodden path, and we think our strategy is a good, solid strategy. That might mean we're not going as fast as some people would like us to go sometimes, but it's about discipline, and we'll stick to we'll stick to the knitting in terms of the disciplined operating model that we've got in place.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm going to try one last cheeky one. Obviously, I think in December we saw Woodside's changing CEOs this year. I know some investors in Woodside would like to potentially see you as that candidate. Are you willing to categorically rule out any concerns that Santos investors may have that there's risk you might leave for the Woodside gig this year?
Look, Saul, that was a cheeky one. I'm not going to bite in that one. That's a question for others, mate. And I'll give you 10 out of 10 for trying, but I'm not going to bite in that one. Thanks very much.
Fair enough. Thanks. That's all from me.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Daniel Butcher from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me this time?
You can, Dan.
Great. I'm not sure what happened last time. I got kicked off. Look, just quickly, just following up on the WA backfill opportunities, you've given timelines for three of them. I'm just curious whether you'd give us a bit of guidance about what the development cost per buoy might be for those, or any precedents we should be looking at to give us a bit of a feel for that.
Look, I think we did give guidance on that in the Investor Day pack. I don't have those numbers on right at hand right now, but what I would say is that all of those WA gas assets are very low-cost, life-cycle cost developments, and that's what makes them so attractive. And I think, from memory, they're all in the sort of $2 per gigajoule type range. So look...
The best way to think of it, Dan, is we're just going to look at the numbers. We'll get them all.
Right.
But I've got
the pack in front. If you go to the Investor Day pack, you'll see it's in the $2.40 sort of range, break-even cost of supply. That's Australian dollars, so less than $2 US. So pretty low-cost developments.
Near-field tiebacks, close to infrastructure, shallow water.
And I think that's what makes them attractive assets, is that or opportunities, I should say, is the fact that they're tying into existing infrastructure, which is already heavily depreciated.
All right, thank you. I'll check that out. And just another quick one on North Australia unconventional. What sort of realistic time frame do you think it would take to prove those up and then also develop it if it has legs?
Well, look, I mean, I think... I would suggest we wait and see what the results of our horizontal wells we're going to drill this year are. We're pretty excited based on the results from our Tanumbarini 1 well, but obviously that was a vertical well, and so now we want to go and drill a couple of horizontal wells this year. We've got the rig getting ready to mobilise for the dry season, and once we see the results of that well, that will give us a much better indication of what we're looking at. And if it's successful, then we can start looking at, because what we're going to really do there is determine what sort of scale we want to develop that on, and what the market opportunities for that are, because obviously there's East Coast gas market opportunities. That would take a lot of scale because of the cost of transportation, and then there's north to Darwin as well. So look, I think we'll just wait to see the results of these two wells before we speculate on development timing going forward. But certainly exciting prospects.
All right, great. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from Baden Moore from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Kevin. I was interested in your thoughts on the East Coast gas market at the moment. It looks like pricing, at least in the spot market, seems to have decoupled from netback LNG prices for a little while. Is there opportunity there maybe to be increasing your production through GLNG, and if not, why not? And if the pricing that AGL is talking about of $6 to $7 a gigajoule for 2 to 3 year contracts persist, does that start to impact your thinking on what you're doing with Narrabri? Do you think you still have a bit of flexibility on timing there to just continue to push out if pricing isn't there? And are you still looking at doing any sort of tolling arrangement for GLNG? I know that was something you have historically talked about.
Yeah, okay. A lot of questions in there. Let me see if I can try and cover all of them. First of all, on East Coast gas pricing, I think why you've seen the decoupling is because I think the government's ADGSM strategy that they put in place in 2017 has been effective. I mean, frankly, all the LNG suppliers are putting gas into the market, and that's meeting all the supply requirements, and consequently that's put a bit of a price cap on the domestic market. And even though you saw LNG prices run high recently, albeit temporarily, you haven't seen that come through in the East Coast gas market. I think the other thing you say about East Coast gas development is that the price is very much, it's got to be driven by cost of supply. So there's only so low it can go. It cannot go below the cost of supply. And if it does, that will shut in supply. Supply will stop. Nobody's going to develop new reserves for a loss. And now most of the new reserves coming into the East Coast gas market are from unconventional or onshore fields. Hence, their annual drilling programs that are going to develop those reserves to meet the demand profile of the domestic market. That means it's very easy to stop drilling if the price goes below your cost of supply and the market should regulate. I think that $6 to $9 range is the range that the market operates most effectively in. If it goes below 6, I believe supply will shut in because of what I just said. You know, a lot of operators would be cost of supply $6 or more, Australian, and so they would struggle to be able to develop and maintain production at those prices. And I think that's what you're seeing in the domestic market now, that it's kind of in that range, and it's a combination of cost of supply upward pressure with the additional supply being put in by the three LNG projects in Gladstone to balance the market. In terms of that $6 to $7 that you're talking about, at the end of the day, for new developments, you're only going to develop them when you have offtake arrangements or price certainty that makes you confident you're going to get the right rate of return for that project. And that would be no different for us with Narrabri. We certainly wouldn't be delivering or developing Narrabri if we didn't get the price to support that. And we've said that we're targeting a price of a cost of around $6 ex field for the Narrabri project. We're confident we can deliver it at that. We think that will be the most competitive price gas that goes into the Sydney market. Now, I don't know if that
is there any opportunity? Is there any opportunity to be increasing production in this market from GLNG?
Well, look, I mean, we've been very focused in the last 18 months on indigenous production at GLNG, and GLNG is going really well. I mean, I'm really pleased with the performance. This time last year, we were very optimistic we were going to beat our guidance at that time. I think we'd set around 6.2 at the time, and we were on a trajectory to go significantly higher than that. Unfortunately, with the DQTs throughout the year as a consequence of the pandemic, of course, we've pared that right back to just around the 6 million ton mark for the year. This year, we've given guidance at 6.2. We're very confident we'll deliver on that. You can see how Roma's performing. It's ramping up beautifully. Arcadia has outperformed some of our expectations. And just generally, the field is performing very well. And I think as we get, you saw some reserve adds this year. That's the first time in a long time we've added more reserves than we've produced across GLNG. And I think what you're seeing now is as we get more experience of operating these CSG fields and our knowledge of the reservoirs is building, our confidence is also building. And so I'm very optimistic about the future of those fields, and our focus is very much on Indigenous reserves at this point in time. 2020, all discussions around tolling and other commercial arrangements ceased. You know, it was very much about dealing with the pandemic. I would hope some of those conversations will kick in again as we come out of the pandemic and we start to think more about the long-term structures to maximise value through this project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Tom Allen from UBS. Please go ahead.
Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, Kieran and Anthony. Can you provide a bit more detail on the timing for FID on the Moomba CCS and share some colour on how important that project has been in providing LNG buyers options to work with you on CCS or to preserve the option on future possible carbon credits in securing those LNG SPAs with Mitsubishi and SKENS?
Well, first of all, it wasn't important in securing any of those agreements or relationships that we have today, but I believe it will be in the future, right? But I'll come back to that in a second. Let me start by giving you an update on the project. The project is now technically ready to take FID. The government and the Clean Energy Regulator are working on the methodology statements that will support the accreditation of CCS projects for the Australian carbon credits. The expectation is that that will be around September this year, and then we'd be in a position where we could take FID. We can't take FID before that because that would then eliminate the possibility of the project being eligible for credits. And so, obviously the economics of the project are very, very different if it qualifies for credits, and hence we're not taking FID until that work is done. The good news on that is that the Prime Minister is supportive. The Minister Taylor has pushed this very hard. He's very supportive of CCS qualifying for credits, and I'm pleased to say we've got bipartisan support with the other side of politics coming out and saying they support CCS qualifying for carbon credits. And even at a state level, the Premier here in South Australia is a big fan of this project because it not only will help us reduce emissions here in Australia, but it provides jobs, and it provides jobs for the long term. The Cooper Basin can take up to 20 million tonnes of CO2 a year for the next 50 years at least. It's a phenomenal opportunity for Australia to really get on the front foot when it comes to Paris and emissions reduction technologies globally. And so we're glad to be part of that story, and we're glad to be leading with the Moomba CCS project. It's a world-class project. We've given you the details of it before, but I'll reiterate, life cycle costs less than $30 Australian for this project. And when it's up and running, we think the sort of operating cash cost of operation would be around the 6 to 7 or 6 to 8, not 6 to 8, a Scottish accent, 6 to 8 Australian dollars per tonne operating cost. So we believe that's the lowest cost CCS project globally. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that we have all that infrastructure in place to capture the CO2 already in the Cooper Basin. So we're very excited by it. In terms of how that plays out for future LNG projects, you know, we want to maximise the volume of CO2 that we can capture at Moomba. And I'd be saying to governments, even think about putting infrastructure plans together. Pipelines coming from the Beetaloo, we believe, should come via the Cooper Basin, because it offers that decarbonisation opportunity for that gas going into the East Coast market, which I think future-proofs future gas development and the gas-led recovery going forward. And so the more gas we can get to go past the Cooper Basin, the more CO2 we can extract to take into the Cooper Basin, and we've got the sink. You know, we've got the capacity there. It's safe storage. It's the same place it's been stored for the last 80 million years or so. So it's pretty secure on any time frame. And so, yeah, very exciting project, and we're pushing forward on it.
Thanks. Thanks, Kevin. Now, the one last question. Just with gearing at 34%, so assuming that the planned sell-downs occur, the CapEx sequencing of your various projects as you enter the growth phase are obviously quite important. Are there options to shift the timing of key CapEx tranches that can just provide further confidence that the balance sheet's well placed to enter the big growth phase?
One of our objectives way back in 2016 when we rolled out our strategy was to take, was not only to increase the size of equity in our core asset, but it was to take operational control and be able to control our own destiny so that we're not being pushed into projects at timings that weren't suitable to us. We now operate all four of our core assets here in Australia, and we're very much in control of the timing. And we demonstrated that in 2020 where we rephased Dorado, we deferred Barossa FID, and you can see we're doing likewise with CCS until the conditions are right. And you know, I call that discipline in terms of how we manage the business. And we'll continue to demonstrate that going forward to manage the twin objectives of meeting our growth aspirations and the management of our balance sheet and keeping the company in a solid position to fund that growth going forward. I'll maybe hand that to Anthony to add some colour to those comments.
Yeah, that's right, Kevin. And I think, Tom, we sort of stressed that at Investor Day and also how the operating model works. I mean, it's important for us to make sure that we keep the discipline of the operating model and balance the sustaining capex, a sustainable dividend, and also managing that balance sheet in that less than 35% gearing range. So all of that balances out, and the phasing and flexibility that we have and the control over that helps us maintain that over the coming sort of 3 to 4 year growth window.
Perfect. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Anthony.
And Tom, just before you run, I don't know if yes. I mentioned our CCS project at Moomba yet, but one other thing I should have said, one other thing I should have said about that project is governments worldwide now know, and they're all publicly stating, the world cannot achieve its emission reduction targets and certainly cannot achieve zero emissions or net zero emissions by 2050 without CCS. And so it's becoming a critical technology on all levels if governments are going to be able to achieve their net zero ambitions.
Thanks, Kevin. That's coming through loud and clear. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your last opportunity to register for a question by pressing star 1 on your telephone. We will pause as we wait for questioners to join the queue. There are no further questions at this time. I will now hand back to Kevin for closing remarks.
Okay, look, thank you everybody for tuning in. Unfortunately, with some of the border restrictions, we won't be travelling to Melbourne in the next few days, and we're going to see you guys by VC, but we are planning to be in Sydney as part of the roadshow and hopefully catch up with many of you next week on that roadshow. But I thank you again for tuning in, and see you all soon. Thanks very much.